Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 10, the last part of the chapter, verses 16 through 43. We're going to call this section of Scripture the Conquest of Southern Canaan. And our context is this. In the last chapter, the first 15 verses, we see the famous incident of the sun standing still at Ajalon, which is right south of Beth Horon, which is right north of northwest of Gibeon, where the Israelites had come up to defend Gibeon from an alliance of five Amorite kings. Those Amorite kings being Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, as we saw in verse 5. And these five Amorite kings are going to get executed in our section today. Again, the overall context of this is referring to the Israelite armies just wiping out the southern end of Canaan. So we start now in verse 16 through 20. Now these five kings had fled, those are the five kings I just mentioned, five Amorite kings, and hidden themselves in the cave at Makkedah. It was told Joshua, saying, "The five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah." Joshua said, "Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave and assign men by it to guard them. But do not stay there yourselves. Pursue your enemies and attack them in the rear. Do not allow them to enter their cities, for the Lord your God has delivered them into your hand." It came about when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished slaying them with a very great slaughter until they were destroyed and the survivors who remained of them had entered the fortified cities. Well, so let's start out in verse 16. Where is this cave at Makkedah? This, of course, is not in the city of Makkedah. It's a cave by Makkedah. The city of Makkedah had actually not been captured yet by Israel. We'll see that in a minute. But the cave nearby had been captured. Now, if you'll look at a map, which I know you can't do now, but Azekah is a town that's about 10 miles south of Ajalon. And Ajalon is about 5 miles southwest of Beth Horon. And Beth Horon is a few miles northwest of Gibeon, where all this stuff started, when the five kings of the Amorites decided to pick on Gibeon, who had made a duplicitous treaty with Joshua and the Israelites. So if you go to south and southwest from Beth Horon to Ajalon to a place about Azekah, about 10 miles, go another 10 miles south of Azekah, and you get to Makkedah. All of this geography, and there's a lot of geography in this section, most of the geography, all of the geography really, is to the southwest of Jerusalem. The hill country runs up north and south through the center on a center line of Canaan, and then once you go west toward the Mediterranean Sea, get down out of the hill countries, you're on the Shephelah of the plains before you get to the coast of the Mediterranean. Makkedah is about 3 miles to the southeast of Lachish, one of the areas where the five kings were, and Lachish is a famous city in Israel history, Old Testament history, so we need to, that's an anchor point, if you will, if you're looking at the map. But just in general, you can trace all these movements through the map a lot easier if you have a map than listening to me talk. Now, it was told Joshua in verse 17 that the five kings have been found hidden in the cave at Makkedah. Now, that's probably not the soldiers who told Joshua. They'd have found the five kings. They would have captured or killed them right off. So somehow the word, maybe a civilian, somehow the word got to Joshua. And so Joshua says in verse 18, "Roll large stones against the mouth of the cave to pin the men inside and then put a guard in front of the stones so they can't get out." Now, what Joshua wanted to do was to hold the kings until Joshua had the time to deal with them. He and the army were too busy chasing down the Amorites, as we'll see in the next couple of verses. Now, the chasing of the Amorites was probably on further south past Makkedah, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, "The pursuit was continued without interruption to Makkedah at the foot of the western mountains, where Joshua seems to have halted with the main body of his troops while a detachment was sent forward to scout the country in pursuit of the remaining stragglers, a few of whom succeeded in reaching the neighboring cities." Well, however it happened, the five kings are holed up at Makkedah. Now, why did Joshua say in verse 19, "Don't allow these kings to enter into their cities"? Well, that would have been bad news for the Israelites, because then the kings could have defended their cities against a siege by Joshua, and Joshua had no siege equipment. He couldn't besiege anybody. Joshua, in fact, is living off the land. He had no siege works, and he didn't have provisions for a long siege. He only has a camp at Gilgal, far off to the east there near the Jordan River. He doesn't have an established capital city. He can't afford that. He can't afford to let those kings get back into their five cities, so he holds them up in a cave. We go now to Joshua 10, verses 21 through 24. which unfortunately is in the middle of a sentence. Going back to verse 20, it says, "It came about when Joshua and the sons of Israel had finished slaying all of them, dot, 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 that all the people returned to the camp to Joshua at Makkedah in peace. No one uttered a word against any of the sons of Israel. Then Joshua said, 'Open the mouth of the cave and bring these five kings out to me from the cave.' They did so and brought these five kings out to him from the cave, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Yarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon." I'm going to describe where these cities are as we go through here, but they're just in the general area southwest of Jerusalem. "When they brought these kings out to Joshua, Joshua called for all the men of Israel and said to the chiefs of the men of war who had gone with him, 'Come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings.' So they came near and put their feet on their necks." Now, verse 21 says, "No one uttered a word against any of the Israelites," and that means no one of the Amorites. No one cursed, no one reproached the Israelites, no one spoke ill of the Israelites for invading them, because they were in complete terror. And that terror might have been advanced by seeing the sun standing still in the valley of Ajalon in the last chapter. Now, why did Joshua execute these five kings? Well, it was to encourage his troops and to further terrify the Canaanites, not to mention the fact that it deprived the enemy cities of a leader, military leader. The ones who were to execute the five kings after putting their feet on the necks of those kings were the chiefs of the men of war of Israel, thus the military officers of some sort. Now, John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown saying that these chiefs, by putting their feet on the necks of the Amorite kings, this was not done as a sort of a barbarous insult, say these commentators. Rather, it is a sign or a symbol of extreme subjection to show what happens to cruel idolaters and tyrants. And we see that in verse 25 as we go there. Verse 25 and 26, "Joshua then said to them," said to the military chiefs who've got their feet on the necks of the Amorite kings, "do not fear or be dismayed. Be strong and courageous." So you see, this is what Joshua's trying to do, is to show that, yeah, we're going to win this thing, despite the fact that the odds are pretty much against us. Because after all, we got the whole land of Canaan allied against the Israelites. The Israelites don't have that many people fighting. In fact, they left most of their army back at Gilgal to protect the women and children, the old and the infirm and the children back there. So they're not fighting with all their troops. And they're fighting an alliance of five Canaanite kings. At least five Canaanite kings. There were others involved in this confederacy also, as we'll see as we go through here. So Joshua's trying to say, hey, we're going to win. Look at you. You got your feet on the necks of the bad guys. We're going to win this thing. And this, of course, was also seen by the Amorites that were captured, and so that would further terrorize the Amorites. They realized that their kings had just got wiped out, especially after Joshua, in verse 26, struck them and put them to death. He hanged them on five trees, and they hung on the trees until evening. Of course, the Amorites would see, or at least some scouts or somebody of the Amorites would see their kings hung on trees, and that would tend to discourage them a good bit. Now, the exemplary purpose of hanging the five kings on trees could not be served at night, and so that's one reason why Joshua pulled them down in the evening. Adam Clark says it would be barbarous cruelty to expose them even further than one day. I don't know why he says that. I mean, after all, they just got killed. What's more barbarously cruel about letting a corpse hang for 2 days as opposed to one day? I really don't know. But the real reason why they pulled them down before night, it was illegal to keep them up over a day because the corpses would pollute the land. Deuteronomy 21, verse 23. His, that means the executed criminal's corpse, shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him on the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land, which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. We go down to verses 27 through 29 of Joshua 10. It came about at sunset that Joshua gave a command, and they took them down from the trees, the five Amorite kings who were hung, and threw them into the cave where they had hidden themselves and put large stones over the mouth of the cave to this very day. Now Joshua captured Makkedah on that day and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. Now that's the city. The cave near Makkedah, of course, had already been captured. That's where the kings were. But then after that, he captures the city and struck it and its king with the edge of the sword. He utterly destroyed it and every person who was in it. He left no survivor. Thus he did to the king of Makkedah just as he had done to the king of Jericho, i.e. killed him. Then Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Makkedah to Libna and fought against Libna. Now there were large stones over the mouth of the cave. What are the options for why Joshua did that? It could be a monument, and you know, large piles of stones were constantly used for monuments, both in the Old Testament and in the ancient Near East. It could have been, though, that the stones were to guard the cave to keep wild animals from dragging out the carcasses and eating them. But I have a question. If that's the reason, why would Joshua even care about that? Another possible reason why he put the stones in front of the cave is to keep the Amorites from getting the bodies and giving them an honorable burial. That probably makes more sense of the three options. You notice, once again, we have this common phrase, the stones were there to this very day. That phrase comes up over and over again in the book of Joshua, and people say, well, see there, that means Joshua couldn't have written the book, but John Gill says he could have written the book when he was very old. I'm not going to get into questions of authorship. I've already mentioned that in the audio on chapter 1. This is not a liberal versus conservative thing. I think a lot of conservative scholars say that there was a lot of stuff added to Joshua, or that other people besides Joshua might have written the book, somebody like Samuel or somebody like that later on. Now, there's another word, day, in verse 28. Now, Joshua captured Makeda on that day. What day is that? The day the sun stood still, or it was the day the five kings were hanged. I think it was the day the five kings were hanged. Adam Clark says this, it is very possible that Makeda was taken on the evening of the same day in which the miraculous solstice took place when the sun stood still. But as to the other cities mentioned in this chapter, they certainly were subdued some days after, as it is not possible that an army, exhausted as this must have been with a whole night's march and 2 days' hard fighting, could have proceeded further than Makeda that night. The other cities were successively taken in the following days. Well, just to give the army a little bit more rest, I tend to think it was the day they captured Makeda on the day they killed the five kings. Now, he utterly destroyed Makeda. That phrase, utterly destroyed, of course, has been controverted. Some conservative scholars say that that just means it's utterly destroyed as a political entity. It doesn't mean that he exterminated every man, woman, and child in there. Of course, that's a big debate. For those of you who are into apologetics, and how could a just God kill everybody in the city? And I'd say, well, fine, if it's not the men and women were destroyed, God still destroyed all the men and women with Noah's flood, so I'm not sure how much that helps the argument out. For those sentimental types who think that God is not just to destroy women and children because he's God. But at any rate, Makeda is destroyed. And then Joshua and all Israel in verse 29, with him, with Joshua, passed on from Makeda to Libnah and fought against Libnah. So that's the next battle. Now, of course, when it says all Israel, that means the war party that had left from Gilgal to Gibeon. A lot of the army had been left behind at Gilgal to protect the camp there. Now, this city, Libnah, that they're going to is about 8 miles north of Lachish. If you look at the map, you go from Hajaline to going southwest to Azekah, going southwest some more, another 10 miles, you get to Lachish. And then if you go back north about 8 miles or so, maybe, BibleAtlas.org has a question mark by it, but if you go 8 miles north of Lachish, you get to Libnah. So they're not exactly sure where it is, but it's down there in the same area. Again, we're southwest of Jerusalem, in the shuffle of the plains going toward the Mediterranean coast between the hill country and the center. Now, Libnah means transparency or whiteness. I like that because I know Chinese has one word for white and one word for transparent, which we don't do that in English. It kind of struck me when studying Chinese. Same thing apparently with Hebrew here. Libnah means either transparency or whiteness. Why, I don't know. It was one of the royal cities of the Canaanites taken by Joshua. Easton's dictionary says it became one of the Levitical towns in the tribe of Judah. In other words, the Levites got distributed that town as part of their inheritance. It was strongly fortified. Sennacherib laid siege to it in the famous siege during Hezekiah's time. It was the native place of Hamutal, the queen of Josiah. This mentioned in Josiah's, the queen of Josiah, the king, Hamutal. That's where she was from. That's in 2 Kings 23. It stood near Lachish. I said about 8 miles. Of course, nobody knows for sure. And has been identified with a modern place that I can't pronounce. So, Libnah is next. We go to Joshua 10, verse 30. The Lord gave it also, Libnah, also with its king into the hands of Israel. And he struck it and every person who was in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor in it. Thus he did to its king, just as he had done to the king of Jericho. What had he done to the king of Jericho? He'd killed him. So that means Joshua killed the king and the inhabitants. It says no survivor was left. That doesn't, again, now let me say, that doesn't prove that all the women and children were slain in there. That claim is controverted by some conservative scholars who say that that didn't happen. That doesn't happen in these conquests. I forgot the name of the Old Testament scholar who made this claim that I read on the internet. I thought it was kind of interesting. I haven't had time to study it closely. But at any rate, Libnah is toast. Now, you know, the term no survivor in Libnah, that could just mean that no soldier survived. not necessarily that there were no men, women, and children, old men and women and children that survived. We go down to Joshua 10, verses 31 through 33. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Libnah to Lachish, and they camped by it and fought against it. All right, so Libnah, we went from Makkedah to Libnah. I hope I didn't say we went north to Libnah. I meant to say we went south from Makkedah, southwest from Makkedah to Libnah, and then we go from Libnah to Lachish. And Lachish is about 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem, about 8 miles south of Libnah. As Adam Clark says, it was a very strong place. It took Israel 2 days to conquer it. Even though Israel had two advantages, the people, the Canaanites, were panic-stricken by the sudden destruction coming upon them by the invading Israelite army. And also the Israelites were flushed with success. They were winning battle after battle. Now the second day, it says, they were taken. In verse 32, it says that. The options for what the second day mean, it could be the second day from the slaughter of the kings in the cave at Makkedah, or it could be the second day since they encamped before Lachish. I believe that's what it is, because it was such a strongly fortified city, it took them 2 days to get it. It says in verse 32, Lachish was struck, and every person was killed with the edge of the sword. There's no mention of the king being killed. That's because he was one of the five kings killed and hanged in the cave at Machpelah, which happened just a little bit previous to this. Now in verse 33, we see some reinforcements coming up for these poor Canaanites. Horam, king of Gezer, came up to help Lachish. Now, Gezer is about 20 miles due north of Lachish, so they had come a fairly long way, 20 miles. So let's look a little bit, let's examine a little bit some information about Gezer. As I said, it's 20 miles north of Lachish. It was a precipice. I mean, Gezer means a precipice, according to Easton's. It was an ancient royal Canaanite city. In other words, a king lived there. It was allotted with its suburbs to the Kohathite Levites. That's in the distribution of the land. The Levites got cities, remember, not tribal areas. And so they got Gezer. It stood between the lower Beth Horon and the sea, the Mediterranean Sea. It was the last point to which David pursued the Philistines after the battle of Baal-Perazim. The Canaanites retained possession of it till the time of Solomon, when the king of Egypt took it and gave it to Solomon as part of the dowry of the Egyptian princess whom he married. An interesting little factoid. And it is identified with Tel el-Gezer, a modern place about 10 miles, or a modern mound, about 10 miles southwest of Beth Horon. It is mentioned in the famous Amarna tablets. At any rate, Horam came down from Gezer and he got himself killed for his trouble. Because it says in verse 33, Joshua defeated Horam and his people until he had left no survivor. And that would, of course, include the king. We go now to Joshua 10, verses 34 and 35. And Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Lachish to Eglon, and they camped by it and fought against it. They captured it on that day and struck it with the edge of the sword. And he utterly destroyed that day every person who was in it, according to all that he had done to Lachish. Now, where was Eglon? Well, they're not sure, at least BibleAtlas.org is not completely sure. It has a question mark by it. But if you'll look 5 miles south and southeast of Lachish, about 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem, about 3 miles south-southwest of Makkedah, you'll see Eglon on the map. So it's close to Lachish, we can say, close to Makkedah, close to where the text has told us that Joshua's been wiping out these cities. This is the next city going south. Now, when we see the city Eglon, we need to distinguish Ekron, and I always have trouble confusing those two. That's a famous Philistine city, the five famous Philistine cities. It's about 20 miles north-northwest of Eglon, way up there. So we don't want to make that confusion. Eglon was destroyed. Every person who was in it, typical, wipe them all out. And remember, Eglon's king was not there. He was in the cave at Machpelah, so he was killed he was hung back up at Makkedah, but the rest of the city was destroyed by Israel in verse 35. We now go to Joshua 10, verses 36 and 37. Then Joshua and all Israel with him went up from Eglon to Hebron, and they fought against it. They captured it and struck it and its king and all its cities and all the persons who were in it with the edge of the sword. He left no survivor according to all that he had done to Eglon. This is typical, no survivors. And he utterly destroyed it and every person who was in it. Now, every person who was in it, that sounds, that could be every soldier. It does sound like every woman and child. I'll leave that up in the air. Now, where is Hebron? It's about 12 miles northeast of Eglon, going back north a little bit, but mainly east. If you look at the map, it's on a direct eastern line from Makkadah, about 10 miles or so from Makkadah. And it's up in the hills, up at the top of the hills there. And, of course, Hebron is that famous city that's still there today. It's one of the most ancient cities in the world. I don't know whether it or Damascus is the most ancient, but it's still there. It's owned by in the Palestinian Authority right now. It's the famous place where Abraham buried all of his relatives in the cave of Machpelah. Of course, Abraham just had a little piece of the area. The place was basically pagan. So they captured it and struck it and its king. Well, there's a couple of problems here. First of all, if Joshua wiped out Hebron, why did Judah have to recover the city in the time of the judges? We see that in Judges 1 verse 10. So Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Why did Judah have to go against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron? Well, obviously because Israel had lost Hebron from the time of Joshua's first conquering of it until the time of the judges, which of course is a couple centuries later. Here's some of the optional reasons how this happened. Some of the city had escaped before the taking of the city, and they joined other Canaanites driven out of their habitations. So the escaping Hebronites, along with some other Canaanites, came back and repeopled Hebron. Now, this, of course, assumes that when it says that all their population was killed, it doesn't mean every last man, woman, and child. It means that a lot of them were killed. We have that debate that would affect this answer here. Or it could just be because Joshua, after capturing the city, didn't garrison the city, leaving troops behind for fear of weakening his army, and so people could, the pagans could come back in, the Canaanites could come back in and take Hebron again. John Gill says that Judges 1:10, the verse I just read that said that Judah went against Canaan, is actually just a look back at this particular conquering of Hebron right here, and so it was not a retaking of the city of Hebron. But Adam Clark points out the problem with that is Judges 1:1 says, "Now it came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel came and said, who will go up and so forth." And then it's after the death of Joshua is sort of the context that would govern verse 10 is when Judah came back in and took Hebron from the Canaanites. So I tend to think that the city of Hebron got taken over again by the Canaanites. Now in verse 37, another little problem here, verse 37, we see Joshua striking Hebron and its king. But remember, the king of Hebron was stuffed into that cave near Makkadah. So now we have another king at Hebron. Now, where did this king come from? Well, it could be that Hebron had already set up another king. Or it could be this is just referring to what happened a little while earlier at Makkadah. The slaying of the king that had happened at Makkadah is just recited here. So the verse is telling us what had already been done. Now it says not only Hebron was taken, but also the cities of Hebron. That means that Hebron had other cities dependent on it and subject to it. So we go now to Joshua 10, verses 38 through 40. Then Joshua and all Israel with them returned to Debir, and they fought against it. He captured it and its king and all its cities, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed every person who was in it. There's that phrase again, utterly destroyed. He left no survivor. Just as he had done to Hebron, so he did to Debir and its king, as he had also done to Libna and its king. Then Joshua struck all the land, the hill country, the Negev, and the lowland, and the slopes, and all their kings. He left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed, there's a phrase again, he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Now let's locate Debir on the map. If we see Hebron and Machpelah on a east-west line, almost 180 degrees, perfect straight line, Hebron to the east and Machpelah to the west, about, well, I don't know, 8 or 9, 10 miles or so. And then Eglon from Machpelah is about 4 miles southwest. And then from Eglon to Debir, you got about, what, 8 miles or so to the southeast. So if you look at a triangle between Hebron, Machpelah, and Debir, an upside-down equilateral triangle, Debir is at the southern tip of that triangle, if the triangle is upside down, remember. So we're getting further south now at Debir, and there's a question mark by that on BibleAtlas.org, so they don't know exactly where that is. It's in the hill country, according to this map. Here's what Easton says about Debir. The word Debir means oracle town or sanctuary. It's one of the 11 cities to the west of Hebron in the highlands of Judah. It was originally one of the towns of the Anakim, that's the giants. It was also called Kiriath Sefer and Kiriath Sana in Joshua, chapter 15, verse 49. Caleb, who had conquered and taken possession of the town and district of Hebron, offered the hand of his daughter to anyone who would successfully lead a party against Debir. Othniel, his younger brother, achieved the conquest and gained Achsah as his wife. We'll read about that in Judges chapter 1 and chapter 3. Achsah was not satisfied with the portion her father gave her, and as she was proceeding toward her new home, she lighted from off her ass and said to Caleb, her dad, "Give me a blessing, i.e. a dowry, for thou hast given me a southland, a desert, a waste. Thou hast set me in the land of the south in the Negev, outside the rich valley of Hebron, in the dry and barren land. Give me also springs of water." And he gave her the upper springs and the nether springs. Great story. We'll get there when we get there. Debir has been identified with the modern Ed Darir, I can't pronounce it, some Arabic name, the well on the ridge to the south of Hebron. I've got a note to myself here. Distinguished the king of Eglon, the city we've already talked about. That king's name was named Debir. Well, I don't know where that comes from. I assume my note is accurate. This Debir is also called Kiriath Sefer and Kiriath Sana, as Easton's pointed out, Joshua 15:15. Then he went up from there against the inhabitants of Debir. Now, the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. Kiriath means city. Kiriath Sefer, Joshua 15:49, and Dana and Kiriath Sana, that is Debir. Now, although it is stated in verse 39, there was no survivor after Joshua's attack, but it seems the city recovered again, because after Joshua's death, the city was retaken by Othniel. That's the story I just told you. Judges 1:11-13, then from there he went against the inhabitants of Debir. This is Caleb. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer, and Caleb said, "The one who attacks Kiriath Sefer, i.e. Debir, and captures it, I will even give him my daughter Achsah for a wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it. So he, Caleb, gave him his daughter Achsah for a wife. Othniel was not Caleb's younger brother. He was the son of Kenaz. And Kenaz was Caleb's younger brother, so that makes Othniel Caleb's nephew. And the nephew Othniel got his daughter Achsah. They didn't worry too much about degrees of separation in the lines of consanguinity. Now, verse 40, all of this southern conquest is summarized. Joshua struck all the land. He got the hill country. That's the mountains that go up the spine of Canaan, the Negev. That's the southern part right down there, about halfway down the Dead Sea coast to the west of the Dead Sea. All the way down to Beersheba, the Negev, and then the lowland would be the Shephelah, the plains. As you go east and you get out of the Negev desert, you get toward the Mediterranean coast. Now this word, and the slopes that Israel also got after Joshua struck the slopes, I'm not sure what that is. The King James has king springs, which might make some sense, but most of the modern translations have slopes, and that sounds redundant, hill country and its slopes. Maybe it's just redundant. But at any rate, the summary is, he utterly destroyed all who breathe. And again, there's that phrase, utterly destroyed. And he did all this as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. Well, when did God command that? That would be in Deuteronomy 20, verse 16. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. I'm telling you, that language doesn't sound like women and children survived. You shall not leave alive anything that breathes. Again, language can be confusing as you go between cultures and languages. I understand that, but it just sounds pretty strong to me. Now, John Gill says that the law here, as God has commanded in verse 40 of Joshua 10, why is that mentioned? Well, because it needs to be clear that Joshua was not doing this out of revenge or cruelty or inhumanity. He's doing it because God told him to do it. He was the executioner of God's justice. He was basically a judicial authority. You don't blame the executioner for pulling the switch in a legal execution. In the same way, you don't blame Joshua for carrying out vengeance on these idolatrous and pagan tribes. Here's what John Gill says. What they did was not of themselves, the Israelites, nor from a private spirit of revenge, nor a greedy desire after the substance of the inhabitants, but in obedience to the command of God. And who ordered this as a righteous punishment of those people for their gross abominations of idolatry, incest? And so John Gill goes to, hey, God's got a right to execute people who are deserving of capital punishment. That's John Gill's approach. Adam Clark, John Gill's the Calvinist, Adam Clark's the Arminian. I say that because Arminians tend to be a little soft on the justice side and strong on the sentimental side. Clark says, in order to defend the Israelites, he says, quote, "Is it reasonable to say those were slain who were found in arms? Of the others, they made slaves?" In other words, he leaves open the possibility that utterly destroy means utterly destroy the nation of the city as a ongoing political entity and destroy the soldiers, the men who were found in arms. The women and children were made slaves. And again, if he's right, well, fine. That makes God look a little bit nicer. But remember, God wiped out all the women and children who were on the earth during the time of Noah's flood, too. So continuing along this line, Adam Clark says, quote, every person found in arms who continued to resist, these were all destroyed. Those who submitted were spared. But many, no doubt, made their escape and afterwards reoccupied certain parts of the land. Again, that doesn't sound like all who breathed were destroyed, but we do have to account for the fact that pagans ended up coming back into those cities because Judah had to take those cities later in the time of the judges. Interesting theological problem. We go now to Joshua 10, verses 41 through 43, and we will finish this chapter. Joshua struck them, the pagans, from Kadesh, the Canaanites, from Kadesh Barnea, even as far as Gaza, and all the country of Goshen, even as far as Gibeon. Joshua captured all these kings and their lands at one time, because the Lord, the God of Israel, fought for Israel. So Joshua and all Israel with them returned to the camp at Gilgal. Now Joshua struck them from Kadesh Barnea. Now we're really moving far south from Debir. Kadesh Barnea is all the way down to the wilderness of Zin, which is past the southern tip of the Dead Sea. It's right near the Wadi El Arish, which runs from the Mediterranean down into the desert, or maybe vice versa. It might run from the desert into the Mediterranean, probably the way it goes. And that's the border of Egypt, northeastern Egypt. That's the border of Egypt and Israel. And so, and Kadesh Barnea was on the edge of Edom. Edom was south of the Dead Sea, running all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, or close to the Gulf of Aqaba. So Kadesh Barnea is way down to the south, past. So that's just summarized real quick. Joshua wiped out all the way down to Kadesh Barnea. And then he says, even as far as Gaza, we look at the map. Gaza is on the Mediterranean coast. It's south of Ashkelon, famous Philistine city. And Gaza was one of the Philistine cities. But it's way over to the east from Lachish, Makeda, Eglon, and Debir, the cities we just talked about. Well, if he took those cities, but then he went far over all the way to the coast and got to the coast. So he went east of the coast and south down to the wilderness of Zin, right before you get to the wilderness of Paran, which is right before the Sinai Peninsula. In other words, way down to the south in the Negev. Now let's talk about Gaza. It means strong. A city on the Mediterranean shore, remarkable for its early importance as the chief center of a great commercial traffic with Egypt. Of course, it's still there today, the Gaza Strip. This is from Easton's Dictionary I'm reading. It is one of the oldest cities of the world, just like Hebron, just like Damascus. Its earliest inhabitants were the Avims, who were conquered and displaced by the Kaphtorims, a Philistine tribe. In the division of the land, it fell to the lot of Judah. It was the southernmost of the five great Philistine cities, which gave each a golden emerald as a trespass offering to the Lord. Isn't that great? Giving a golden hemorrhoid to the Lord. I mean, I'm sure God was really pleased with that sacrifice. Its gates were carried away by Samson in Judges 16. Here, Samson was afterwards a prisoner and did grind in the prison house at Gaza. Here, he also pulled down the temple of Dagon and slew all the lords of the Philistines, himself also perishing in the ruin. Famous story about Samson. The prophets denounced the judgments of God against Gaza in Jeremiah, Amos, and Zephaniah. It is referred to in Acts 8:26. Philip is here told to take the road from Jerusalem to Gaza, which is desert, the desert road. Gaza is noticed on monuments, that's in the ancient Near East, as early as B.C. 1600. So there's Gaza. Let's talk about Goshen in verse 41. Joshua is said to have taken the land from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza, all the land in between there, and so the country of Goshen was between Kadesh Barnea and as far as Gibeon, which is 4 or 5 miles north of Jerusalem. That's way up there from Kadesh Barnea. And Goshen is somewhere in between. And it's very easy to confuse this Goshen with the land of Goshen, which is way over in Egypt, the northeastern corner of Egypt. But that's not the Goshen it's talking about. It's talking about another place whose place has been lost. The archaeologists and the scholars do not know where it is. BibleAtlas.org says this, quote, unidentified. Easton says this Goshen, which of course is not the Goshen of Egypt, this Goshen is a district in Palestine. It was a part of the maritime plain of Judah and lay between Gaza and Gibeon. Well, that's just what I said. Then nobody knows where it is. But the point of all this was to show that Joshua had conquered a lot of land to the east of the cities he just fought, all the way over to Gaza to the east of the coast, and all the way south to Kadesh Barnea, past Beersheba, all the way south, all the way to the Wadi El Arish in the wilderness of Sin. The conquest is complete, so they go back to Gilgal. And in verse 42, it says the conquest was done at one time. Well, what does that mean, at one time? It means on one campaign, because the God of Israel fought for Israel. In other words, this was such an incredible deal to manage to conquer all the Canaanite cities in one campaign that it had to be that the God of Israel was fighting for them. And so Joshua heads back to Gilgal, and that's where we'll leave this chapter. We're now prepared to go to the next chapter, Joshua 11, verses 1 through 23. We'll look at conquest in northern Canaan. The south has been conquered. The north is coming next in the next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.